Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I'm extremely excited once again because making her seasonal debut after a busy, busy summer of, I'm assuming, Olympiads and holidays and SIAD, it's Allison Rudd. Also joining me in the studio once again, and it's becoming a bit of a habit here, it's Julian Lorenz. And finally, joining us from a remote undisclosed hotel in the West End of London. I suspect he's going undercover because you'll see his voice will sound rather muted throughout the podcast. It's Mr. Matt Dickinson.
Good morning.
There you go. Obviously, one place to start this weekend, although we will be talking some Swansea and we're talking some West Ham and some violence, maybe even some Rabonas too. But obviously, we need to start in the possible potential capital of world football. Manchester. Dicko, let's begin with you. One obvious talking point when we saw the team sheet were no Anthony Martial. Remember the first sort of 3 months of last season when United kept talking about what a brilliant deal Martial was and how he was going to be the greatest player in the world? And no, they didn't overspend for him at all. So no Martial, no Juan Mata, another sort of former Manchester United record signing. Instead, we get Mkhitaryan, who had been injured during the during the international break, and Jesse Lingard, who I believe had also been injured and we hadn't seen in a while. Did that surprise you, and what was Mourinho thinking there? Was he trying to surprise Pep too?
Mkhitaryan, I don't think, surprised me hugely, just because, you know, we know his quality and the sort of money United was spending on him, the fact that he's a manager's new signing. You know, you can imagine that he wants to integrate him pretty heavily in his first 11, but Lingard was a surprise, and well, even more of a surprise when you saw how he played. I mean, he's, you know, we've seen him, you know, he's a decent, very decent, you know, blossoming young player. But I mean, he looked like he's out of his depth. He looked scared. He looked, you know, the ball rolled over under his foot a couple of times, and he just looked like a guy who was, whether it's a combination of overawed or just not on his game or just not quite sharp enough, whatever it was, he had an absolute stinker. And like Mourinho said afterwards, it's, you know, it's his job to pick the right team. And obviously managers can't always predict how a player's going to react. But, you know, he dropped a couple of clangers there.
Allison, we know Mkhitaryan was injured during the international break. It's always difficult to tell when players are fit, although you have highly paid doctors and stuff to go and determine this. I can only assume that he told either the United's medical staff passed him fit and he told Mourinho that he was fine. I take Dicko's point about wanting to integrate him, but he didn't start him earlier when he was fit, and now he starts him now in their big derby game when maybe he was less than 100%. Could you just talk a little bit about how managers navigate this? Because we've all been around footballers. Everybody wants to play if they can. And then nobody ever wants to admit that, you know, oh, no, I've got a bit of a knock, right?
Yeah. Well, it's extra baffling in this case because Mourinho's reputation is somebody who wants his players to do more work than they might like. So if you've got any, if you're not 100% fit, it's really hard to work in a Mourinho team because he wants you to track back. He's not interested in someone playing because they are an exceptionally gifted player, and that gift allows them to absorb the fact they might not be, you know, they might have a slight knock or not be totally on it because he wants you to be... Mourinho wants his players, yes, to be skillful, but he also expects them to put in a real shift. And certainly over the last few years, that seems to have been his... Maybe all his career, actually. But certainly it was deemed his downfall at Chelsea. He put graft ahead of skill and annoyed people. So it is extra baffling why a player who, as you say, Gab's no secret, there would be doubts over his fitness, A, would want to go into a big match like that knowing he couldn't graft and exhibit his skill, and B, Mourinho not think, well, it's just not worth the risk, even if a physio or whatever says, I think he's all right, gaffer. It just adds to a quite long list of baffling decisions Mourinho made. And I know that's not actually what you wanted to talk about. You wanted to talk about players pulling the wool over managers' eyes, didn't you? But I think that's slightly old-fashioned. I don't think it's as common now, is it, Julian? I don't think it is.
No, I don't think it is either. I'm more surprised that if you look at that starting lineup, Mkhitaryan's best position is not on the right-hand side. It's shorter centrally. Paul Pogba's best position is not in a two midfield like that on the left hand sides, and Marwan Fellaini's best position is not a holding midfielder. Why do you?
Because not everybody can play. I know where you're going with this. Not everybody can play behind the striker.
Exactly. And,
you know, this is Juan Mata's best position probably is there as well.
Like 3-1-1-1-1-1-1-1 exactly. And everybody behind the striker. But maybe in a game like that, in such a big game where you know that the other team is probably better than you or better equipped than you are, surely you have to play players in the best positions at least.
If only Mourinho had a guy who was young and very, very fast, and we were told was a Thierry Henry's type, and for the first 3 months of last year, they kept going on about what a great signing he was, even though they paid an arm and a leg for him. You know where I'm going with this.
Yeah. And imagine if they had another one
who was English,
who could look like Nicolas Anelka, and who has a lot of pace. And the last 3 months of last season was amazing.
Seriously, what is up with Martial? Is he not fit?
No, he is fit, and he did actually quite well with France. He scored against Italy, his first international goal in a friendly in the international break.
Does he not do enough defensive work?
It's the only reason why I could see him being dropped. Otherwise, it's a very stupid choice.
It was also, I think Julian, you know, hinted at it there as well. It's not just the choice of those players behind the striker. It was the deeper in midfield as well. Yeah. I mean, you know that Pep, you know, he doesn't dislike midfield players. He likes midfields within his midfields. I mean, that is his philosophy. It's clearly what he's doing at City, and they seemed, you know, ill-equipped right in front of the defence, never mind behind the striker. So there was multiple issues with that Man U midfield.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dicko. And I think in this game, that first half, notwithstanding the mistakes at the end, and we'll get to Mr. Bravo, but City were so dominant in midfield, and Mourinho, to his credit, recognized this and adjusted it at halftime, you know, by putting on Herrera at least now. Then, you know, they had three guys in there; they weren't getting pushed around in that way. But if we can turn over to City for a minute, we knew they were going to try something like this. Did you think, Dicko, that they would be so good at it? And also, what's up with Fernandinho? I mean, I know people focus on De Bruyne or whatever. I thought Fernandinho played a virtually flawless game.
No, just brilliant, brilliant. And well, I mean, I think we knew that City were capable of this. We saw them the first half against West Ham. It was just, you know, a joy to watch. I guess what I'd expected was that, you know, a manager like Mourinho would see that, would know exactly how City were going to try and play, and would have the resources to disrupt. And, you know, we know Mourinho's not afraid of you know, closing down a game, making it however ugly he wants it to be. And that was the surprise, I guess, that, you know, City were doing all the things we love to see from great football teams. You know, Silva was just exceptional, as you say. Fernandinho was pretty much flawless. De Bruyne was, you know, making you think, why could anyone ever sell him? But it was the fact that, you know, they were sort of unruffled in doing it that was the big shock. You know, I think that was the surprise.
Well, it's a good point that he makes about being unruffled. Matthew Syed writes it. Well, there's a lot on this. Matthew Syed writes about it in the game. Henry Winter talks about the you know, how the possession ties in with the defensive side of the game. This idea of passing, and I think there's a bit of an evolution from the old Guardiola tiki-taka, because that was kind of like sideways, oscillating, wait for an opportunity and then seize it. This is much more vertical. I mean, it feels like in every pass, they always have the option to turn and go and shoot or create an assist. And if it's not there, then it goes back. But of course, one of the elements in this was Claudio Bravo. Now, Alisson, we know that we can't really trust foreign goalkeepers against Premier League crosses because, of course, they're different. So maybe it's no surprise that, you know, the weak Chilean surrender monkey went and just spilled the ball, right? Because he can't handle the physicality of the Premier League the way brave Joe Hart would have. Because he didn't spill a ball at the weekend either. No, I'm kidding on that.
You are kidding on that.
Before we get to Bravo's mistakes, but what did you make of this idea that it did feel a little bit, because I've seen a lot of, I think we all have seen a lot of Guardiola teams at Bayern and at Barcelona. And yes, Manuel Neuer and Victor Valdez were both very, very good with their feet. But I didn't see them playing the way Claudio Bravo did. It was almost as if like, oh, look, I want to show everybody that I signed this guy because he can play with his feet, and I'm going to make him go and play with his feet continually. It just... Did you think that was a bit overdone? Maybe it's just me. He didn't do this before. Neuer was not passing the ball 50 times a game.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, it looked... The way you've described it, Gab, that is what it looked like. I find it staggering that might be true, that... I mean, there's a narrative, isn't there, that the only step that Pep Guardiola's maybe got wrong or maybe annoyed a few people or raised eyebrows is the unceremonious dumping of Joe Hart. And the way you, if you're a strong manager, the way you handle that is to kill off any speculation that you might have made a mistake or be too draconian by putting in the replacement player that you say will do all the things that you're not going to get from the previous goalkeeper, and make a point. That isn't good management. That isn't how you manage a team. You don't make political statements during a match.
Yeah, well, sure, but he wasn't doing that. But
it did look like that. It did look comic book exaggeration.
I don't know. Would we be talking about that if it wasn't for? I mean, there were obviously a couple of incidents, and obviously we're getting on to the Rooney thing, where, you know, there was complete attention drawing playing on the ball. But otherwise, you know, if you're using, especially if you get a lead, if you basically recycle the ball back through the goalkeeper, who is comfortable at that, who is in good distribution, I didn't feel it was over the top until a couple of mistakes happened.
What was over the top, for example? There's a time in the first half where Otamendi is on the ball. He can pass it across to John Stones easily because there's no pressure. There was no pressure at all from United in the first half. But he goes back to Bravo first, and Bravo passes the ball to Stones, which you don't usually do. Otamendi is good enough to pass the ball across to John Stones. And even on the first goal, if you look at the first goal, Kolarov gets the ball back, and then no one again put pressure on him. The first time he has the ball, he still passes it to Bravo alongside the goal line, if you want, and then Bravo gives it back to him, and then he hoofs it forward. But it looks really like Pep said to all his defenders, when you have the ball, pass it to Claudio, and then Claudio will pass it again.
Maybe it is some kind of psychological ploy. On the Bravo issue, and we'll get to the Rooney incident, I look at this, and I know, you know, it's Joe Hart is generally a nice guy, and people feel he was hard done by, so maybe we're a little bit...
Maybe not all of us.
I know, you don't like him, do you?
No, it's not a question I don't like him.
Well, he looks too Aryan.
I did call him a prat in print a couple of weeks ago, because I thought the way he handled the summer in particular, it was sort of almighty hubris of... He was walking around like, you know, cock of the walk at the four games. He was being a prat in his dealings with us as well. You know, he crashed to earth pretty spectacularly. That was... Yeah. There's quite a bit to mix in there.
I need to interject this. So for people who don't know, Dicko, you were covering England at the Euros, covering England at a major competition, which is not something that I have done in terms of going to the England camp every day. It just sounds to me like an absolutely horrendous experience.
I'm still traumatized.
So other than people who've experienced that, but it seemed to me there were a lot of people who were ready to jump on Bravo if he made the mistakes, and he made, let's face it, he made at least what, three enormous mistakes that could have easily cost them the game if you count the Rooney incident as well. But I kind of feel that I'm not overly concerned here, Dicko. Am I right in not being overly concerned?
Yeah.
Because we know he's a good goalkeeper. He made one mistake because of obvious miscommunication with Sanya. He made another mistake, I think, because of miscommunication with... Was it Stones he was jumping with?
The mistake on the cross, I mean, I think there is, you know, look, he's an experienced keeper. He's had to deal with a lot of...
Yeah, he's a foreign keeper, though.
But banging around the boxes. But, you know, I think we're allowed to a bit of adjustment time. But, no, I think, look, it's clear that Guardiola thinks he is a better distributor as a key issue than Joe Hart. As you say, we saw Joe Hart can flap at crosses and make horrendous ricks at the weekend as well. Pretty much any goalkeeper is capable of doing that. Equally, we can see, and maybe Saturday was not the best demonstration of it, we can see that he thinks that Claudio Bravo is a guy who can, you know, be part of a built-in-the-back team in a way that Joe Hart can't. And I think, not saying, you know, Pep Guardiola makes every decision right, but I think we can see the thinking at the very least, and we need to give it a few more weeks to see it play out.
Anybody here want to make a case that Bravo is not an upgrade over Joe Hart? No? Okay, good. Let's move on and talk about the Wayne Rooney incident. And in some ways, I'd like to also tie this into what happened afterwards when I thought Rooney was in big trouble. When he went to press Bravo, Bravo passes the ball away. And it looked to me like Rooney just swings out his leg and takes an almighty whack at him. And that didn't get much play. But the Bravo thing was Bravo takes a heavy touch, Rooney comes in, and Bravo goes in with, I thought, with a lot of force to win the ball, rightly so, but also with his foot up, and I thought that was a penalty. I know some people disagree, but let's turn to a qualified referee.
I don't know why people are disagreeing with you, Gab. You know, we keep saying it, you have to make a judgment call on what you see as a referee, but if you've seen it a few times, it is clearly almost textbook penalty. It's dangerous, reckless, it's everything. You can throw all the adjectives you need to know as a referee at it.
I disagree. Did he get the ball first?
Doesn't matter.
No, I'm just asking you, did he get the ball first?
Yes, yeah, he did.
With too much force. And his feet off the ground.
He got the ball first.
I have to say, it's a classic case for video where a video replay, you know, which we know is on the way. But this is a case where, is it a clear enough mistake that the referee is overruled? Because as Julian says, he gets the ball. Now, I think he gets the ball with excessive force. I think most people think it's excessive force. But that is that is a personal judgment. And it's an interesting one to think that if the referee has seen it pretty well and thinks it's borderline, whether in this instance there would be a sort of case for, no, you've got that horribly wrong, that must be overruled. I think this is a classic case where it would fall into a grey area, which to say, I think if a penalty was given and a card, then we could all understand why.
Well, it's maybe a debate for another time, but you do raise a great point, because this is something where you have to judge the person's force, right? Because there's not any dispute that he got to the ball first. And judging the force with which somebody goes in on a replay, I think, is very different and perhaps misleading. It's one thing to use video replays for when there was contact, there wasn't contact, the Cahill thing, which we'll get to. But to me, it was a penalty. One thing I wanted to throw out there people who maybe were strikers in the past, if Rooney had stayed on his feet rather than sliding to win the ball and just kind of run into Bravo, would he have got there quicker and maybe won the penalty?
I don't think so. I think he gets there because he slides backwards. And if he doesn't slide tackle, and it's, for me, it's a 50-50. The ball is in between them. They both go for the ball. They both slide tackle. One with a bigger force than the other. I give you that. Bravo. And he gets the ball first. But if Rooney hasn't tackled and slide tackled, I don't think he would have got the ball, and it would have been an even cleaner tackle from Bravo, and Rooney would have just jumped over the leg, and that would have been it.
All right. So much for my theory there. So Mourinho has a point. This would have changed the game. Yes.
Well, in terms of these games, you know, substitutions, getting the right team in the first place. I mean, it's one of the many things. I mean, you know, it's that's life.
Right, enough of that. Let's move on to Swansea, where the Liberty Stadium, Swansea hosted Chelsea. I don't know if we should start with that first half or if we should just start with one of the absolute worst penalty decisions. One of the worst refereeing decisions I've seen in a long time. And
you weren't even on the moon.
This is true. I missed that point. But Alison, I'm just going to go to you because you have to be the defenders of all things referee. But I want to ask you one thing that I don't like talking about body language. People in this country seem to love talking about body language. After Cahill goes down and Leroy first scores the goal, Cahill sort of approaches Mariner. And in the TV pictures, he just looks at him with this look of absolute disdain. Like, oh, you little dog turd stuck under my shoe. This patronizing smile and everything. I don't think Mariner would want to see that back. And I would imagine right now as I speak, Mike Riley's watching the pictures and shaking his head and saying, like, we don't want our referees behaving this way because you really look like an absolute idiot.
I don't know why he looked like that, but I suspect he looked like that because
he thought Cahill was trying to con him.
No, because of what Cahill was saying and because of what he did see and what happened, he might well have been thinking, oh my giddy aunt, I might have got that wrong. And the way you cover that up is to look as stern as you can, and it just looks the mixture of embarrassment and.
But he wasn't looking stern; he was looking mocking.
I know, but I don't think he probably meant to look that mocking. It's just that if you're in the public eye and you don't want to look an idiot, you can end up overcompensating and trying to look statesmanlike, and
I do that with my 11-year-old all the time.
I'm assuming nobody wants to go and argue that, in fact, Leroy Fer got the ball cleanly from Gary Cahill and it was not a penalty. This is a really major refereeing mistake. We can look at the reasons why, but it was a major refereeing mistake, yes?
Absolutely.
I think Howard Webb was spot on in the game this morning when he just said it's one of those ones where it's just everything about it, you know, there should be telling you, you know, there's no reason why Cahill's going to go down. There's no reason why, you know, it's just sort of, it's such an unnatural thing to happen that, you know, as he describes it, it's just one of those safe free kicks to give.
Gary Cahill's so upset. I've never seen this from an English player going out and getting onto the Match of the Day cameras and going to visit Mariner to talk about, and obviously wanted to clear his reputation. I think some people may like Cahill, somebody not, but he's obviously somebody who generally does not have a reputation as being a dirty player or a cheat. And he seemed, the Match of the Day segment seemed to go on and on and on. He seemed so upset. And I can fully understand that and sympathize. Is this also maybe Chelsea being a little bit clever just to drive the point really home that, look, we were really hard done by and we left 2 points behind, and that's maybe almost designed to plant the seed and the heads of some people?
Well, that implies he's been told to look annoyed and cross.
Well, no.
Indignant.
Listen, I don't think Gary Cahill goes to see the referee without Chelsea's permission. I don't see any context where a club just allows their player to go like, oh, okay, why don't you just wander down the hallway and go knock on the referee's door?
But I mean, Cahill might have said, I really want to.
Well, that's
really
fine. But then somebody at Chelsea made a decision and said, okay, fine. You know, we trust you to go and be civil. You know, we're not going to let Diego Costa do it because who knows what's going to happen.
given that Chelsea, well, there's also, let's remember the sort of context of Chelsea and referees, which is a pretty pretty explosive volcanic relationship under a particular manager. So, as you say, it's not something you would allow a player to do lightly, especially when you've had the disciplinary issues that Chelsea have had in the past.
I want to talk about something that happened in the first half, which again they made a big.
Sorry, just to finish on Leroy Fern and Cahill. He didn't see it. it's quite clear from when you look at the footage that the way Mariner is positioned, he can't see it. Neither can his linesman, the one on
and
that
the fourth
side of
official
the pitch.
Is scratching his rear end or trying to keep Antonio Conte calm. So like, there's nobody.
No, but like, you know, it's a huge mistake. It's a bad mistake. But in fairness to him, he can't see. He's not gonna. If he doesn't see it, he's not gonna make it up and say like, because the ball moves. The ball moves exactly in the way. If you can't see it, that Leroy Fer could have had a touch on it, and then Cahill stumbles.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And then Fer gets the ball back. You can't see that the ball moves because it clattered into him, and then it's actually Cahill who moves the ball away. Mm-hmm. And if he can't see it, he's not going to make it up and just say, okay, well, he goes too quick anyway.
Yeah, and that's where I disagree with you, Dicko, and Howard Webb in saying it's a safe free kick to
it's
give.
Not, yeah,
just because it's unusual for a defender of that calibre to make that mistake doesn't mean you have to assume it was a foul.
He could have
you can't make that assumption.
You know, it could have been anything. He couldn't see it anyway, so...
Well, yeah, but as Gav said, one of the it's extraordinary that one of the assistants hasn't seen an angle on that that has just warrants
positioning was probably not good enough.
Well, and also I'll go back to this: if there was an additional assistant referee behind the goal, then you know. Since, but it's okay because we all have to laugh at them and say they're lollipop men and they don't do anything. Ha ha ha! Let's all laugh at them.
No, but even the video that Dico was mentioning earlier,
yes, or
which
is on
his way, would have been overturned and there would have been a free kick for Chelsea and game would have gone on.
I want to go back to something that happened, which is more of a generic thing happened in the first half. They did make a big deal out of it. So Swansea go out and Francesco Guidolin decides to be uber Italian and go three at the back. They get absolutely mullered by Chelsea in the first half. Diego Costa, fantastic. And so, with 4 minutes to go, he says, all right, let's change the system entirely, which, again, is pretty normal in Italian football that you would change the system. Less normal is making a change during the first half. But it's minute 41. He takes off Neil Taylor. He puts on Barrow so that they can switch, I guess, to a 4-3-1-2. Neil Taylor is hugely upset. Hugely upset on the bench. Guidolin. Sorry, my aging Italian manager.
You've got so many that, you know.
Goes over, tries to shake his hand, which, again, looks to me like you're making this into an even bigger issue. After the game, he says, I have to say sorry to Neil Taylor. Is this really that big? I mean, these are professional footballers, right? Neil Taylor supposedly said, oh, you could have waited till halftime. What, does he think people are going to like him less or think that he's rubbish? Or does he think his fans are so stupid to not realize that the reason he took him off wasn't because he was bad, but because he was moving to from back three to a back four?
It's English tradition. You don't
he's
haul,
Welsh.
You don't, the English game tradition. You don't haul people off before half time unless they're injured or you think they're playing really shite.
And
although that isn't the reason why in this case, it does matter that the players. His self-esteem will plummet and he will think,
why? The system didn't work because of me.
He'll think it's because of me. I couldn't make three at the back.
I'm sorry, I've never met Neil Taylor. I think he's a reasonable footballer. Although, wait, was Neil Taylor the guy in the incident with Pepe Reina back in the day when he threw himself to the ground?
No.
Anybody remember this? Right, whatever. Wasn't Neil Taylor who got Pepe Reina sent off years ago? Right, maybe, if it's not, I apologize. But I've never met the guy. Maybe one of you has. I am still surprised that a 26, 27-year-old international footballer who's been at the club who's for a long time, I think he came to the ranks there, would be so upset and unprofessional over something like this when it's obvious you're not being taken off.
It's not nice. It's not nice. It's not nice.
It's never nice to be taken off.
Yeah, but even less so after 41 minutes. But he has to
understand. It's less nice than to concede another three
exactly.
or four goals
exactly.
and go and lose five and
exactly.
be 4-0 down at halftime.
I don't understand why he looks so upset and like.
Tico, help me here.
I agree with you. It's a tenuous system. I mean, it's pretty simple, isn't it? As you come off, the manager says to you, look, sorry, mate, I'm about to sacrifice you because I got the system wrong. Say Taylor's in touch. But I think most managers would turn around and say, look, let's talk after the game,
But would most managers have gone and apologised in public to match of the day the way Guidolin did?
No, exactly. I don't think he needed to. I think, if you want to, in terms of man management, as he comes off, if I were a manager, I'd turn around and say, look, sorry, I've had to change the system. But, I mean, that's as far as it needs to go during the game. And let's have a chat afterwards.
As far as Chelsea are concerned, Antonio Conte was very unhappy, although perhaps pleased by Diego Costa's performance. Did make the point that Diego Costa needs more protection from referees. It did seem to me that between Amat and Fedor Fernandez, those two guys took a few liberties with the big man. This is just par for the course now because of his reputation. He's not going to break out of this, right, Alison? I mean, this is...
Yeah, I don't know. I find the Costa and discipline thing really weird. I think on balance, I don't know if referees are overcompensating in some way, but he gets away with more. He still gets
so?
Away with more. Than a lot of other players who might play the same way would. It baffles me. Almost every game I see with him in it, there's a sense of he was lucky not to get a second yellow or a straight red, and yet rarely does. I don't get how that works at all. I don't get how that works at all. I don't know. I don't know why. I think referees are scared that they're looking at him too closely. That they want to accept that he has a certain personality and style of football.
So he doesn't actually need more protection.
I don't know.
He needs less
protection.
There you go. Pay attention, Antonio.
Someone back me up there. Do you never feel that way when you watch Costa? How did he last the whole game? I often think that. I think he's a great player, but I often think, wow, that was close. He was skating on ice there.
I very rarely think, poor little lamb, he did.
Let's move on because... at the Olympic Stadium, no, sorry, the London Stadium, which I guess is what we're supposed to call it until they go and get it sponsored by some Chinese company, West Ham took a 2-0 lead. They lost 4-2. But there were apparently all sorts of clashes and incidents of violence. Here there's a fundamental difference in the way the game is covered in England versus the way the game is covered in my country is that I didn't see any pictures of this in television. I didn't see any pictures of fighting fans or people rowing with stewards. Did any of you guys see it?
Only stills, no. Not actual footage. No.
Is this?
Yeah, I've spoken to a mate who was there and said it was. Yeah, there was definitely, as you say, it wasn't sort of, charges or the sort of fighting we saw in the summer. But there was, there was a lot of gesturing, gesticulating, a lot of angry people shouting at each other.
Is this a conscious decision? I'm just asking, I don't know. Is this, and there's, if it is, there's a good reason for it, I guess. Is this a conscious decision by Sky or whoever's cameras were there, the Premier League, to not show this stuff? In other words, not to cover it as a news event, but simply as we're here to produce a piece of entertainment, which is a football match. This other stuff, we don't want to show this because it...
I might be wrong, but I don't think so. I think it's more a case that what happened wasn't graphic enough or visual enough or easy to pick out, unless you were just the one person with the camera trained on the crowd. I mean, it's hard to cut to or focus or linger upon things that are, it's not like bottles were thrown or people had blood trickling from their forehead. It wasn't. I just suspect on the day no one thought it was that interesting.
Dicko, so we have a piece in the game this week by by a guy named Josh White. It's a very personal piece about sort of the experience of going to this stadium. I haven't been to the stadium since West Ham moved in. But a lot of the issue seems to center over this idea of standing. I mean, it seems to me that the argument he makes is that there's two elements to it. One is the issue of standing, and the other one, which maybe is more interesting, is the issue of the fact that suddenly you have many more tickets available. They're cheaper, and maybe it's attracting a different sort of crowd. Some of it good, because you get more kids and people who could never afford to go to football before. Some of it maybe people saying, like, oh, look, for 20 quid, I can go and start a ruck. Dicko, I want to talk about the standing first. I don't understand why there are different policies in different grounds around the country.
I think it's not... Well, policies of stewarding as much as anything. I mean, obviously, you know, the regulations say that you should sit down if you have a seat, and obviously all the top two divisions are all-seater, and it's meant to be, you know, that is meant to be enforced. Now, as you say, there are different levels of enforcement. I went to Chelsea in the back of Matthew Harding for a game last season, and no one was sitting down the entire game. It was just accepted that if you were in the area, you would have to stand up to watch it. And that becomes the case at various different parts of different grounds around the country, I think. But as the among the issues, West Ham seems to be the fact of stewarding. Obviously, they're in moving. There's a different stewarding company involved, as far as I understand. And obviously, there seems to be an issue with where it was being enforced, how vigorously it was being enforced by different stewards. And that's among the issues. Obviously, another issue with West Ham is that people have moved seats, and people have sort of... There seems to be a sort of mix of some people who are used to standing up in the old Bobby Moore stand at West Ham, and maybe mixed in with other people, families or otherwise. So there's a lot of issues here that are clearly sort of... a cocktail that is a pretty unpalatable one at the moment.
It just doesn't seem to me that they thought about this well before, because even the easy way where Watford fans or some of them went into the West Ham stand, the West Ham fan stands, to get a fight, looked pretty, from the videos I saw on Twitter, it looked pretty easy for them. And I just wonder if West Ham had thought that one through well enough before moving to the new stadium, on where and what kind of people we're going to see where. Because like Dicko said, you could have a stand where everybody, where those fans there, you know, want to watch the game, where you know that stand is going to be maybe for the more hardcore fans, and that those kind of fans are going to stand up the whole time. You can have another stand where you have more family-orientated crowd, maybe. I don't know. But at least make sure that away fans can't get into home fans' stands and don't get a fight as easily as they did on Saturday.
I agree, and I think it takes, you know, I mean, the fact is, we all know that, you know, when fans are in a stadium for a while, you know, it just develops. Different parts of different stands develop their own character, and as you say, you sort of get an area which is the hardcore, and if you're going with your kids, you learn by experience not to go back to that area. You learn that, you know, obviously there are some areas that have family stands and stuff. Now, I think, you know, West Ham's priority has just been getting as many bums on seats as they can. And I think that's an issue for them, certainly. So I think I think it's, you know, it's clearly taken a while for people to learn, actually, the hardcore are going to gather here. Families should gather here, and not enough has been put in to make sure that, you know, those are distinct. Also, it brings up the whole safe standing debate, which is clearly back on the agenda, which... I mean, it's interesting. Celtic have started that now, but it's they're a first, and it's clearly, for all the talk that it's been, you know, it's been lobbied for well over a decade now, it's a very, very slow this argument.
It seems to me that what's happening now is that clubs are kind of operating a don't ask, don't tell policy, where, as Dicko said, there are certain grounds where certain areas, especially the home fans, stand the entire time. And generally, at least a lot of games I go to, the away fans stand the entire time. Mm. And it's fine, because they're going to that area and they expect to stand. The problem with standing, I think, I don't think there's still this health and safety issue, although I know there's always health and safety people everywhere in this country. But the reality is that, you know, in a certain area, there's only going to be a certain number of people to get in. So if you have 500 seats and there's 500 people standing, it's much less of a health and safety issue. That you're not going to get a crush or things that we've seen happen elsewhere. Where it is an issue is if I go with my granny, who's 99 years old, she doesn't want to be getting up the whole time. Or if Julian goes with his son, who's mm-hmm. 3 feet tall, and, you know, Matt Dickinson is standing in front of him, standing and jumping up and down, the poor kid's not going to be able to see. So I'll
punch Matt Dickinson in the face.
Exactly, and then we have what we saw. But the issue is, in a perfect world, they designate those areas as standing, but they can't do that, not yet anyway. So they kind of operate on this sort of gray area situation, which, I mean, I think at some point they need to sort out. Right, how about some quick hits? Liverpool roll to a 4-1 thumping of Leicester City, and it all comes together for Jurgen Klopp under his new gigantic stand, which is so big that it blocks out the sun. But that's okay, because there's the red of the Kop to provide all the illumination needed. Alison, are you filled with renewed hope?
It was really peculiar, because I did not expect the new stand to make such a difference. It felt like a brand new stadium in many ways. It was odd and disorientating, but then reassuring that the noise levels were better and the acoustics worked, and it felt like it could become a fortress. I am slightly concerned that Klopp said, "Oh, they can build a new stand every week," as far as he's concerned, because you can't have that sense of it being a special occasion just to lift the players. They have to do that all the time, regardless of how many builders have been in.
I don't think they're really going to build a new stand every week.
I'm not worried that they're going to build a new stand every week. I'm worried that was a great performance, but I don't want it to be a one-off just because they had to christen the stand.
Just enjoy Sturridge and Mane and guys like that. Arsenal edge past Southampton 2-1 in a hard-fought affair. Julian, what do you make of the newcomers, Mustafi and Lucas?
I thought Mustafi looked good, very good. I think him and Koscielny could prove to be a very good partnership. I think they complement each other really well. Lucas Perez, it was a difficult game for him because he needs some space to run into. He's got good pace, and I don't think we've seen him sprint for more than 2 yards, so it was always going to be difficult, the kind of game difficult, but he will have to get used to it if he wants to be successful at Arsenal, because he's not going to have much space at all through the season.
Oh, corollary to that question, can you guys name 3 defensive partnerships, or even just 2 in the Premier League, that are better than Mustafi and Koscielny? Anybody?
Stones and Otamendi for me, very close, if not better.
But not much in it, right?
No.
Anybody else?
James Collins. Well, when we've got David Luiz back.
Of course.
Yeah,
come
James
on.
Collins and Winston Reid, yeah. No. Maybe Alderweireld for Tonga?
Yeah, maybe.
No, I was a little too Belgian for you.
Yeah.
So maybe we should stop laughing at Wenger and his soft centre if all of a sudden you guys think Mustafi and Koscielny as a partnership are about as good as Otamendi and Stones.
I haven't seen either. I would have. Vertonghen at his best with Alderweireld, I think. But his best seems to be an inconsistent thing.
Okay, so the top three, yeah?
Top three, yeah.
Okay. We can all agree on that. Spurs win 4-0 at Stoke, and Hongmin Son seals the show. Dicko, is Son a bit hard done by this season? Or actually in general? Because I feel like I like him more than a lot of other people do. And are Spurs ready for that great leap forward?
I think we're all growing to like him. I think, you know, he had a sort of soft introduction to the Premier League last year. It's not a huge surprise, given, you know, there's quite a lot of competition for that role behind the striker. I think we're seeing that there was a chance that he might have gone in the summer, and I think they'll, you know, be glad to keep him. We'll see more of him. And I learned with Pires, never judge a player after one season in the Premier League. I made a big mistake with him, and maybe we all will with Son too.
Yeah. By that logic, I don't want to judge Janssen just yet, but I would take Son over Janssen, even in a centre-forward role.
Every day.
Speaking of Stoke, they're bottom of the league, and Mark Hughes complained that his players are picked on by referees. Alison, you're the qualified ref here, which makes you the automatic spokesperson for the PGMOL. sort of like a female Mike Riley, if you will.
Lucky me.
Indeed. So, yeah, you know what's coming.
Yeah. Well, studies have shown that bigger clubs get more decisions in their favour. But studies have also shown that home teams get more decisions in their favour. So maybe Mark Hughes should look to harness what can be an incredible atmosphere at the Britannia and stop moaning about niggledy-pickledy things.
Should he moan about the fact that after being sent from the bench, he wasn't allowed to yak on the phone to Mark Bowen?
He couldn't get his phone to work.
But eventually, when he did, they told him, no, you can't do that. New rules, which I think kind of makes sense. If you're sent off, in fact, if you're sent off, you should be sent off. You should send a chaperone with you, and you have to go sit in the bowels of the stadium.
Yeah, it makes more sense.
West Ham go 2-0 up at home to Watford and then fall apart, losing 4-2. Julian, does the buck always stop with a manager when a team defends that badly? Or would you rather praise Watford? And actually, which Frenchman do you like better, Dimitri Payet or Etienne Capoue?
I think Bellic, who we all love, made a mistake by picking James Collins. Who on earth would pick James Collins to play in the Premier League when you've got Ogbonna on the bench? Even Nordwald could play as a centre-half.
Avenging Angelo Ogbonna is coming for you.
Yes, exactly.
6'3", eyes of blue.
But Watford,
not quite. Not in his case. But
Watford deserves a lot of praise because I think they played well, and it seemed they got spurred on by the showboating from West Ham as well. And then it's hard. Payet or Capoue, it's like shooting my mum or my dad. You know, it's hard. It's a hard question. I'll have them both in my team.
They are two of your favourite Frenchmen in the Premier League, aren't they?
Which do you prefer, your mum or your dad?
My dad every day.
Crystal Palace went away to Middlesbrough and Wilfried Zaha steals the show. Alan Pardew hints at the fact that he's a £50 million man, which kind of reminded me when, I don't know who it was, didn't somebody once describe Sean Wright Phillips? Oh, it was Kevin Keegan once said Sean Wright Phillips was a £50 million man. And I wonder if, in my memory, but this could be entirely wrong, so don't get angry at me, Martin O'Neill might have said that about Kenwyn Jones. But Dicko, is Zaha that kind of £50 million man, or does he actually have a future with England and so on, and can he become a legitimate £50 million man?
Well, the way the English premium is going, he'll be worth £50 million pretty soon. I think he's, like Barkley, he's got talent, but we spend so much time arguing about temperament, about application, about use of game intelligence, and that's what winds me up. You know, we've got ball playing ability here clearly, but he's got to do it a hell of a lot more consistently to get to 25 million, never mind 50.
Gab, I've got a question for you. England's number one, John Hart, made his debut in Serie A this weekend. How did he get on?
He made a very good, this was against Atalanta, he made a very good save, and everybody thought like, oh look, this will be a dawdle. But then, as you know, historically, English keepers have trouble dealing with crosses. we're being unkind here. He made an absolute wreck-it on a cross into the box, which is not what you expect. And he's going to bounce back. You know, people saw the good and the bad in him. People, I think, want Joe Hart to do well. Now, if he has many more games like that, he won't be starting there either because Torino's backup goalkeeper, Padelli's actually pretty decent. So it'll take some getting used to. I think this is a test, and he can emerge from it stronger. I don't think he'll be hurt by this performance as much as he was hurt when Matt Dickinson called him a prat. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my guests, Julian Lawrence, Alison Rudd, and Matt Dickinson. Now, I will not be back next week
I am going away for a week. I'm joining, you guys may know my friend Dave Clark, who does the darts on Sky. Dave is walking coast to coast across the north of England. I had no idea that you could even walk coast to coast across the north of England, but he's doing it to raise money for Parkinson's. It's a cause that I've been touched by as well. It's a cause I believe in. So I will be joining him for the last 5 days of the of Dave's walk. So that means I cannot be with you next week. We'll leave you in the capable hands of somebody, hopefully Alison Rudd. And during the walk, I'll be sending updates on Twitter. So if you, as I understand it, you have to understand, then this part, rural England, is very foreign to me. I have been up north, but generally I don't stray too far from the train station or the football ground, and I hurry back to inside the cocoon of the M25. So this will be very interesting for me. It's a real test. I'm going to a place called Darlington, and then I'll be going to places like Reith, a place deceptively called Richmond, but it's not Richmond. It's some northern thing with the same name. I'm making my way to Whitby. I'll be posting updates on Twitter. If you guys want to come in the evenings, I'm staying in pubs. I didn't realize pubs have accommodation in this country. I'm sure that we'll be glad to have a pint with you if you happen to live in the countryside. So, yeah, and of course, you can also go and sponsor me or sponsor Dave. I've got it pinned on my Twitter feed. So, yes, thank you for listening to all this. Now, remember, it's just £12 for a 12-week trial. If you want to subscribe to The Times, it's really easy. Just search The Times online. And, of course, you can also subscribe to this podcast, although if you're listening to us, you probably already have.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Till next week. Bye-bye.